Yeah, thanks very much to Alessia and Celine for inviting me. So the talk will be somewhat generally about, or will be an overview really about aspects of dynamical frames and gauge theory and gravity. And yeah, it's kind of a summary of these, mostly the first three papers. So I'll be basically mostly sketching results or giving intuition because yeah, these the first three papers, they have about 250 pages together. And yeah, the topic starts with a very basic notion that's in physics, quite in general, of course, if we want to make interesting statements or develop concrete descriptions of physical processes, then we often need to introduce some kind of reference. And the very fact that we need to do so means that there's, of course, also some kind of ambiguity. And this ambiguity leads to different accounts of different descriptions of the same physics. And usually these are, of course, related by some kind of covariance principle or some kind of relativity principle, often associated with some kind of group. Now, in systems such as gauge theories or gravity, that's, of course, also the case. But there's something special about systems that have a gauge symmetry, namely that they lead to a kind of relationalism. And in the sense that when you want to make physical statements, you actually need to resort to some internal or dynamical references. So in contrast to what we might be used to sometimes from, for instance, Newtonian physics. And the very gauge-induced redundancy that comes through the gauge principle also means that in general, we don't have a unique such internal or dynamical reference. And so that means quite generically, we'll be getting descriptions that are gauge invariant, but that also depend on the choice of reference. And these descriptions are, of course, most often rather non-local. Now, it's, of course, something that's usually well accepted that something like this happens, but something that perhaps isn't often appreciated is how to actually formulate these internal references somewhat more explicitly as dynamical reference frames that are associated with the gauge group, in fact, and to also address covariance issues related to different choices of dynamical frames. And that's something that we want to discuss here broadly in this talk. So just to give you a very simple example to get some intuition from electrodynamics really is if you want to, for instance, look at some or describe some electric circuit and assign voltages to different parts of it. That's not something you can do unambiguously, but you have to have some kind of reference. For instance, if you have some electrician, then depending on how they do it, maybe they attach it by their thumb or so. And well, the voltage you assign really depends, of course, on what the reference is, but it's something gauge invariant, as it only depends, for instance, on the electric field, some curve of the integral curve along the electric field. Now, if the electrician is fortunate enough that perhaps they're charged in such a way that there isn't any voltage that they assign to certain parts of the circuit, then they can, of course, touch that circuit without getting a shock. But you know, maybe some other electrician is charged in different ways, and if they touch the same parts, then they might get a shock. And so that already tells us here, these are, of course, gauge invariant descriptions or in some sense, gauge invariant experiences that these different electricians have of the same components of some circuit. And of course, they depend on the reference that they each come with. And these references are in both cases, of course, dynamical systems. These are charged objects, these observers. And of course, one can try to relate these different experiences or descriptions of these two electricians. Now, more generally in gauge theories, if one wants to measure something like charged objects, then you also need some kind of reference because by the very nature of particles being charged, they transform non-trivially under gauge transformations. And for instance, one wants to measure, let's say here, this left particle, perhaps an antiparticle. One reference in which you could do that is by looking at some particle itself and connecting them by some kind of Wilson line. And in this sense, you can look at the red particle and the Wilson line as providing a dynamic reference frame, for instance, for that charged particle. Now, of course, one could describe the same blue particle also relative to some other reference. That might be another positively charged particle, and there might be a different Wilson line connecting the two. again, these are different gauge invariant descriptions, references of descriptions of really the same blue particle, but they of course will give different accounts of what the properties of that particle are. Now let's go to gravity and look at gauge invariant observables in gravity. Here, of course, gauge transformations are Bach diffeomorphisms that move Bach points around. And well, since they're gauge transformations, we of course want to have observables that are invariant under those, by which I mean that if you have some a diffeomorphism F that acts on the field configuration that I just collectively denote by phi, by push forwards, well, that the observable isn't affected by that. So usually one hears that is, of course, a great challenge to construct such observables in gravity, but a priori that's not quite true. You can have, for instance, any covariant top form of this form here. So covariant in the sense that it transforms in this particular way. And then I can just integrate that top form over spacetime. And then just by some integral identities, I'll find that that gives me, of course, an invariant observable as gauge invariant. And in particular, if I choose R to be basically the Ricci scalar, then I'll get, of course, the Einstein-Hilbert action. Now, however, such observables are a priori, of course, extremely non-local and maybe phenomenologically not so interesting. And the real challenge is how do you construct phenomenologically interesting gauge invariant observables that have some kind of local information in gravitational systems. And just as an example, of course, if you look at something like a scalar field, then transforms by push forward in this this form under diffeomorphisms, and that already tells us that phi of x can only be gauge invariant if phi is really a constant in spacetime, such as maybe a cosmological constant, or if x is a point on the boundary where gauge transformations might act trivially. So, and that already leads, of course, to some kind of tension between the usual notion of bulk locality that we're familiar with, especially from quantum field theories, and here really in terms of a fixed event labeling. And yeah, the tension is between this kind of locality and gauge invariance. Now, in order to resolve that tension, we have to, of course, adapt at least either the notion of locality or whether we are insisting on something like gauge invariance. And of course, we're not going to give up a gauge invariance. So instead, we're going to adjust the notion of locality. And here, it's important to note, of course, that the notion of locality that fails is really one that's based on a fixed, so non-dynamical, and so in that sense, really an unphysical reference frame. And that leads me to a quote by Einstein. So it's, of course, a bit dangerous to quote Einstein, but just fits extremely well in this context here, who said something like the theory, so generativity introduces two kinds of physical things. So measuring rods and clocks, so basically reference frames and all other things such as any kinds of fields, basically. And this in a certain sense is inconsistent because strictly speaking, the reference frames are measuring rods and clocks would have to be represented also as solutions of the basic equation. So in that sense, being dynamical and not as if they were some self-sufficient entities. And so what we want to do is basically in order to tackle that issue of locality and gauge invariance, basically we want to instead localize fields relative to one another. And essentially we just want to have some kind of dynamical, or that is really a field-dependent coordinatization of space-time. So that's in that sense really subject to the equation of motion. And in particular, if we can have something that transforms covariantly in this form over here. So if the point in space-time that I'm referring to, so it depends on the field configuration, but it depends in this particular covariant way. And for instance, coming back to that scalar field, I can build a gauge invariant combination out of that that I just call here phi, basically relative to x. And then, well, if you just look at how phi and x transform, then well, then you will see that this combination is gauge invariant. And so that really means what the observable is giving us is a value of the scalar fields at a dynamically defined event rather than one that's defined through a fixed reference frame. And so that really gives rise to dynamical coordinates. that are defined in terms of dynamic reference fields. And just for building up some intuition, a toy example, kind of a cute one, is the so-called Z model that was introduced by Giddings, Merrill, and Hardell about 15 years ago. So here they assume that there's some four-scale reference fields parameterizing space-time. And then you can look at, for instance, some combination. If you want to know what the scalar field is at some particular dynamically defined point in space-time, really in the same sense in which I've given to you upstairs, then you can do that by looking at a delta function really on that field space if you want. So it's a delta function that clicks at the point where Z takes a certain value, in this case, Xi. It turns out that this is a covariant top form. So in that sense, it is actually an invariant observable. And it is a relational observable that answers the question, what is the value of the scalar field at the event X in space-time where the reference fields Z take these values Xi. And so this object, if you look at it through this integral, it's of course extremely non-local relative to this fixed labeling. So like these non-dynamical coordinates Y, but it is local with respect to these dynamical fields or this dynamically defined events. And so you can also say it's local in Z space really. Now, that brings us to this idea of relational locality in gravity, of course, that we want to localize physical systems relative to one another. And that's, of course, something that has been around since a very long time, going back to at least Bergmann and Koma, and has been especially pushed by Rovelli and then also later by Bianca and so on in more recent years. But if we have such a physical notion of locality, where we want to localize fields or systems relative to one another, we want to have that to be some kind of viable notion of locality, then we need to at least make sure that certain items on a wish list are satisfied. And then, of course, we want to ensure that we have gauge invariance, yet a physical notion of locality. Also, of course, we want to have non-trivial local dynamics, even in the context where we have Hamiltonian constraints. So where at first it seems that the dynamics looks like a so-called unfolding of a gauge transformation. And if we have different choices of dynamical frames, then we would also like to have a consistency mapping between different such choices. So changing internal reference frame perspective, and in such a way that none of them is really preferred over another, and that we can really frame something like a somewhat more relational version of general covariance, in the sense that all the laws of physics are the same in every dynamical reference frame. And since we talk about locality, we also want to have that specific notions of locality, such as microcausality, hold in this case, so that at the very least we have something like a relational microcausality in the bulk, so defined relative to reference frame. And we would also, of course, want to have some notion of gauge invariant local subsystems or relational subsystems in order to, in this relational world, have possibilities of implementing quantum information notions or thermal notions for subsystem interactions, for instance. So this is something that I will address in this talk. So one thing I won't really talk too much about is dynamics. I mean, it's just the usual notion of relational dynamics, but basically, when it comes to gauge invariant observables, I will sketch a bit how you can define a very general form of how to do that that unifies previous approaches. I will touch on this dynamical frame covariance, and I will also touch on microcausality and subsystems here. And now, let me say somewhat more specifically what I mean by a dynamical reference frame. So okay, here at this moment, it doesn't have to be gravity. It can also, for instance, be gauge theory or even more generally some mechanical systems or so. So a dynamic reference frame is just some system R, so with dynamically reset freedom, that's associated with and transforms in some way under some symmetry group. So most often that will be the gauge group. And what we want to do is we will want to call the configurations of that frame, basically its orientations, to note that by O, it can be the reading of a clock or the orientation of a tetrahedron and so on and so on. And you can do quite general considerations here, but for the purpose of this talk, I will mostly restrict to situations where the frame is actually group valued. So where the orientations or the configurations take value in the group itself, the gauge group. And we're furthermore, the frame is also gauge covariant in the sense that when I look at the action of the gauge group on that frame, that it's really just basically a multiplication by the gauge group element. And so you can also consider much more general situations, but it's much simpler to work with this. And for illustrative purposes, I will mostly look at that. So when we have frames or such dynamic degrees of freedom, what we want to do is basically use these orientations to parameterize G orbits. And we can in particular also use these orientations to construct frame dressed observables, or you may also call them relational observables. And so basically you can say we describe some function or some functional F relative to this frame R. And basically we just use the gauge group action to dress it with in this particular way. This is gauge invariant. So if you act with the gauge group on this whole thing, you can convince yourself that basically the actions of G just cancel and you just get back the original object. And so that's there's kind of a formal argument here, but that's basically how we're going to proceed. And now just to fix some ideas that we will see more generally, also in gauge theory and gravity later, let me use as a warm-up special relativity with internal frames. So that's a quick example, but I think it's a very useful one. And so here we can consider the situation that we have some sort of fictitious external coordinate frame. Let's call it, I guess it should be rather T, Y, X in space-time. And we want to describe maybe some velocity relative to some frame. And so this velocity will transform under space-time Lorentz transformations, of course. These are objects that are, you can say internally indistinguishable when you introduce internal frames. So what would be something like an internal frame? So it would just be something like a tetrad here we can introduce. And the tetrad really amounts to the orientation of that tetrad, or the configuration of it is really the orientation here. And it has a space, it carries two indices, a space-time index, of course, and a frame index. And because it has two indices, it will also have two commuting group actions. And one of them we can basically call gauge transformations. It's really the space-time index version of the Lorentz transformations in this form. And that's, of course, something that'll act on all degrees of freedom, on any kinds of tensors, and also here, of course, on the vector. But then it also has the frame index, and we can also look at something that we might suggestively call symmetries, but that really are frame reorientations that only act on the frame. So these transformations, they cannot act on V, of course, because V doesn't carry such an index A. And here, if you look at the properties of such a tetrad, it preserves orthonormality. And so that means really when you look at this relation here, it tells you that, of course, the tetrad itself is really group valued. It's an object that lives basically, whose configurations live in the Lorentz group itself. So as an example to what I was saying on the previous slide. And we can now use basically this group valued frame, the tetrad, to of course dress any objects we might want to describe, such as the space-time vector V, some kind of velocity, and construct basically a frame dress, the relational observable out of it just by contracting it. So, and then of course that's invariant under what I call suggestively gauge transformations, but it's not invariant under frame reorientations. And now we can consider maybe that there's a second internal frame, it's called just E prime. And there is now, of course, a very simple way in which we can relate the descriptions of these two internal frames, just using the very fact that there's a normalization condition. So if we look at the contraction here, eta can be written, of course, in terms of the second frame. And then if we look at this object here, that's just the description of the vector V relative to the second frame. And this combination here is also a group valued object. And in fact, it's the relation observable that describes the first frame relative to the second frame. And that is also the transformation, this object, this Lorentz group element here, built from these two frames. It is a relation observable. It's invariant under these space-time Lorentz transformations. And yeah, it describes the first relative to the second frame. And then that's really, that gives you basically the transformation from the description of the vector relative between the two different internal frame perspectives. And so this is basically what we're going to do also in gravity and also in gauge theories. So what you see upstairs here is just what I told you before. So in gravity, we'll be looking again for, well, in this case, really dynamical frames. And then just like these tetrads have different in and output spaces, that'll be true also in gravity. So we're going to be looking for something that I call here R inverse. It will be depend on the field configuration, and it will be a map from space-time to something that we might want to call a frame orientation space. And for instance, it may be, can be that this object here is something that's that lives in the, or that's a diffeomorphism from the space-time to this orientation space, in which case it is also something that you can consider group-valued in the same sense in which this object here is group-valued. Now, and then we can also look at what are gauge transformations. Well, these are bulk space-time diffeomorphisms. In this case, they act from the left in this in this particular way, and that's a gauge covariance condition that we will require. And we can also look at these symmetries or frame reorientations. Those are things, diffeomorphisms that only act on this orientation space O, and thereby, so in this case, that means they have to act on the left-hand side of this map R inverse. And because of that, they will also really only act on the frame, but not on any of the other dynamic degrees of freedom in your system. And so I will say more about this now in the coming slides and illustrate this also. In gauge theory, we can do something similar. Here we can consider dynamical frames that are again group valued. So you take their maps, for dynamical maps from space time into the local structure group, which you can also consider as your frame orientation space. And as such, you know, these objects are really elements of the space time gauge group, but dynamical elements. And well, if it's a non-abelian gauge group, then well, we have to distinguish right and left multiplication. And here you can basically then define also gauge transformations as what comes from one side and symmetries that might come from the other side. Just for a bit of intuition, because I won't talk too much about gauge theories, one way in which you can realize that is through something like a Wilson line. You might have some asymptotic boundary with an anchor point that's fixed, and then you shoot in some Wilson line, and that assigns a group valued element to an bulk point X in this particular way. And if you do a gauge transformation that acts trivially on the boundary, then you will get a transformation property of this object that looks exactly like this. Conversely, if you do something non-trivially at your boundary, you might reorient your frame there, or something like a change of local trivialization, that will look like a transformation that comes like multiplication from the right. Now, let me now go into gravity really and say a little bit more about this. So more generally about general covariance theories. And so what we are really looking for is dynamical frames for the diffeomorphism groups. So what we're looking at, so in the same sense in which the tetrads are you know, internal frames for special relativity and for, in that case, the Lorentz group, you know, here these dynamical frames are the analogous stuff for the diffeomorphism group in gravity. And so I don't have a lot of time to discuss that in great detail, but let me maybe just give you one example that provides you some intuition in which you can realize something like such a dynamical frame with these properties that I described kind of generally before. And that is you use something like boundary anchored geodesics. Suppose you have some kind of boundary, and at the moment, let's look at it at finite distance. And on the boundary, gauge transformations act trivially. And then you can shoot in a geodesic or a bunch of geodesics really into the bulk. And then you parameterize bulk points by basically the length of the geodesic in which you send it inwards, plus the boundary point at which you shoot it in, and the angle at which you shoot it in, which you can really parameterize by a boundary vector field. And so the distance tau, the boundary point z, and maybe this boundary vector field, if you really want to look at shooting geodesics in from a whole neighborhood on the boundary, they parameterize a whole set, of course, of such geodesics, but it's an overcomplete set because, of course, many points in the bulk will be hit by several such geodesics. But you can consider those this parameter space as basically being what I called before such a local orientation space. And if we want to get this defines you actually a map here really from this orientation space, a field dependent map through this parametrization here into the bulk of space time. But if you want to define something like a reference frame field, we would like to invert that. But in order to do so, we have to restrict to some subset of this orientation space such that this map becomes injective. And for instance, you can imagine fixing, at least in the local neighborhood, the vector field on the boundary such that if you're in four dimensions, you have three parameters to parameterize your boundary point plus the distance into the bulk. So you get four parameters to parameterize at least the neighborhood and the bulk. Of course, that neighborhood will depend on the field configuration, in this case, whatever the metric configuration is. And it turns out you can show that this object defines you really a set of four scalars that transform in this gauge covariant way under bulk gauge diffeomorphisms that I indicated a few slides ago. And then you can use this object to dress bulk fields and ask for their values, for instance, at the end of such a geodesic, and that'll give you some gauge invariant addressed observable or relation observable that's invariant under bulk diffeomorphisms. You can do something similar with matter fields. There's this Brown-Kukash dust frame, for instance. It works kind of similarly, actually, but works also without a boundary. But in that case, instead of having boundary anchored geodesics, these dust flow lines are really, in some sense, a Cauchy surface anchored set of geodesics, and at least in some neighborhood, they will also provide you a good coordinatization. They define you for dynamical fields that transform also gauge covariantly, and they provide you thereby really dynamical coordinates that you can use to construct gauge invariant observables. So these are really just two kinds of examples to provide you some intuition of how one can actually construct such gauge covariant frames. And in this case, or I should say, in both cases, they define new diffeomorphisms really from at least the subregion in space-time into such a local orientation space. And this orientation space here would really just be what is sometimes called dust space-time. Now, but we want to be somewhat more general than this. And so here, I'm just really going to sketch how to do this. So we want to have a general notion of a reference frame, but we want to resort still to such a gauge covariant dressing. So we want to use such a dynamical labeling of events. And you can just imagine basically any possible way of doing something like this. There will, of course, in general, exist zillions of ways of doing this. And in some sense, if you want to discuss something like a frame covariance, then we should have a notion of, one might want to call it a space of all dynamical frames. And that's what we call a universal dressing space. we call it D, so it's basically the set of all such gauge covariant dressings. It's so in particular, of course, it depends on the space of solutions through its field dependence. So it's it will give you rise to a notion of reference frame that's subject to equations of motion. Now, of course, such a universal dressing space is some horribly abstract object, and it's not something very practical to work with. But we can turn it into something more practical. So first of all, we can basically define somewhat abstractly a subset of such a dynamical frame of the universal dressing space as a reference frame. But if we want to use something like dynamical coordinates, what we want to have is some kind of parameterization of this really weird object D. So to coordinatize really that object and thereby at the end of the day, because You know, this universal addressing space really is a bundle. So it has a projection map that's it's a bundle over space time, and it defines you also. Yeah, there's a projection map from within that addressing space and two points on space time, and because of that, once we have a parameterization of this addressing space, then that will also provide us coordinates for space time. And so what we want is really a parameterized frame, and that's really what I showed you already as an example in terms of these geodesic dressing frames. We can imagine that we have some kind of parameterization, that's what we call a local orientation space, together with some injective map from that local orientation space into this kind of abstract object, this universal dressing space. And then because of the because this dressing space has this projection map into the it's this projection map here into space-time, when you concatenate these maps, it defines you directly a map from this orientation space into space-time, and at least into some neighborhood. And in general, this object O, as in the case of these geodesics, it may be an overcomplete parameterization for a neighborhood in space-time. So it may not necessarily be invertible, but because of this, you know, relying on this gauge covariant way of dressing, so that's the input of this universal dressing space. It turns out that this just because of that, this map that I have here is gauge covariant in that sense in which I write it there. And then if you restrict this now to some subset of the parameter space O, such that this map becomes injective, then I can invert it on its image, and I can invert it on its image because it depends on the field configuration. It really is a dynamical reference frame field from some neighborhoods into this orientation space, and that's a dynamical frame field that you can then use to dress objects and define you then really a dynamical coordinate system that transforms as a scalar. Okay. That's a kind of sketch of how one can generally think of a notion of a very general notion of a space of all frames. And with any such frames, we can construct dressed observables or frame dressed observables that really are the same as relational observables here. So we can imagine that we have some covariant local field quantity, some functional or some form or some tensor or something like this in space-time, and we can then just dress it by using such a dynamical frame field and just pulling it back to the orientation space. So just because of the gauge covariance properties of this object, and because also this is a covariant object, when you look at how this thing transforms under bulk diffeomorphisms, under gauge diffeomorphism, you'll see that it is actually gauge invariant. But yeah, it is now, because I've pulled it back to the orientation space, it's really an observable it's no longer an object such as a tensor field on space-time, but it really is a tensor field on this local orientation space. And because it is an object on the orientation space, I can associate it, it takes values at particular values of the frame. And so, where the frame takes a particular configuration, and really what these objects here, these relational observables, what they represent or what they encode is the information, the answer to the question, what's the value of, in general, some certain component of this object A at the event in space-time where the frame field, in this case, our inverse, is in the local orientation O. And that's a relational observable really in the same sense in which they've previously been discussed, except that it's a covariant object. And now this this object is really relationally local. So it's local in this local orientation space. So it's local to this orientation O at which I might evaluate it. It's field independent on this orientation, on the orientation space, but there's of course a field dependent map between this orientation or value in the orientation space and to some field dependent point in space time. So in some sense I can also say that this object is local to the dynamically defined event in space time. Okay, so one can show, so this is really something rather non-trivial, but that's something we showed in this paper, is that it really unifies previous approaches and also generalizes them. So, you know, dressed observables, as they're often considered, they're encompassed by this. In fact, this construction also identifies in these dressings then how to get really a dynamical reference frame in the sense in which I've explained it before, how you get something like that out of it, or to identify what such a dynamical reference frame is. And when it comes to relational observables, you can show that this actually also becomes equivalent, at least in many cases, to, for instance, this power series construction or representation of relational observables in the canonical formulation that Bianca had developed many years ago. And it's in fact also equivalent to these single integral representations that especially then Merrill and Giddings had represented. To show this would take a bit more time if you want some details, or you can look at the paper. That's a kind of rough summary of how to construct such a very general formalism. Now what we can do is, so we have dynamical coordinate systems, and we can therefore also consider something like dynamical frame changes. And so we can consider, for instance, suppose we have two different dynamical frames. For instance, in the geodesic case, we might have fixed the boundary vector field to two different configurations, then leading to different congruences of geodesics, defining different geodesic frames. And let's suppose we restrict to some neighborhood in space-time that they map to, or at least some field configurations where this is overlapping. So it's non-trivial. And then the way we can do a change of frame map is, in this case, really the same way in which you do coordinate transformations. At least when we have these injective frames, you can invert them on their image. Then you concatenate these frames in this way, and then so you really get so you take the first frame and you map back into space time, and then from the overlap back into the orientation space of the second frame, and that's a dynamical coordinate change really. And this object, of course, is nothing else than the description of the second frame relative to the first frame. So it's really, again, addressing of one frame with the other. So in the same sense in which I showed it in special relativity, where the frame transformation itself was group valued, but it was also a relational observable. And that's something that you see here as well. Now in this geodesic case, that there's a particularly nice interpretation of it. So suppose you have a bulk point that's hit by two different geodesics coming from, say, two different configurations of the boundary vector fields. The way you go from the description in relative to one reference frame of the bulk point is really, you go along the geodesic from the boundary point to the bulk point you're interested in, and then along the other geodesic back to the outsides. And that's really how we can think of that reference frame change in that case. And when you have these frame change maps, so especially if these R maps are actually local diffeomorphisms, you can you can dress basically relational observables by this frame change map, and then that just gives you really the relational observables, they're objects on one orientation space, and when you dress these objects with such a frame change map, it maps them to objects on another orientation space that are gauge invariant. And so gives you a map between different gauge invariant descriptions of the same objects, in this case some tensor T perhaps, and so in terms of frame change. Okay, so that's really very similar to coordinate changes. It's and in fact, when you fix the field configuration, then this is really nothing else than a coordinate change, but it's of course in general dynamical. Now, if you want to cover all of space-time, then we should build something like a relational atlas of such dynamical frames in such a way that their image in space-time covers all of space-time. And then I can define transition functions in the same sense in which I have them here, and then basically obtain a consistent gauge invariant global description of the physics in space-time by many local frames. And this leads me to describe a way in which you can think of general covariance getting updated in a relational way. So And that goes as follows. So you can really, let's maybe talk about implications of general covariance or really diffeomorphism invariance if you want. So suppose we have some diffeomorphism invariant Lagrangian, and then you look at the variation of it in the sense of a covariant phase space. So we have some equation of motion term and some a presymplectic potential. And then if we fix now some coordinate system, so not a dynamical one, then we can describe the equations of motion in such a coordinate system. The way you would want to do that is, for instance, you take these fields using such a map, such a fixed coordinate system. You can write the components of whatever tensor you might be interested in such a coordinate system. And then you can also push forward this whole equation of motion, again, using such a fixed coordinate system to map this object here, which is a priori coordinate three, into some specific coordinate system. And then you have the equations of motion in that coordinate system. So for instance, general relativity, of course, that would look like vacuum general relativity, say like the Einstein tensor, this object here, contracted with variation. Now, general covariance or diffeomorphism invariance actually implies in this case that when you look at the equation, suppose you have two reference frames, such fixed reference frames, that if you look at the equations of motion relative to the first choice of fixed frame, and you look at some solution relative to it, then it turns out that that solution described in the same way, inserted into the equations of motion, described in a different coordinate system, the coordinate systems, of course, have to overlap, it will also be a solution in that other coordinate system. So it means really the space of solutions looks in the two different coordinate systems exactly the same. And that's in particular a way, in or mathematically somewhat more precise way of saying that all the laws of physics are really the same in every fixed reference frame. Now, and these coordinate descriptions of the equations of motion, it's really what are the laws of physics relative to some fixed frame. Now, you get thereby really in some sense a frame-dependent description, because of course, in any particular solution will in general, of course, look different in different coordinate systems. But it's in general, of course, a gauge non-invariant description. And that's because gauge invariant observables, in fact, turn out to be invariant or independent of fixed coordinates. Now, this is the usual notion of general covariance when you think about it in terms of fixed frames. And this is now something that we can update to dynamical reference frames. And basically, we just do the same story as before. And instead of using these fixed coordinate systems, we just use dynamical coordinate systems. And basically, the same arguments just apply. So you describe the components of the equations of motion relative to some dynamical frame. So basically, you write the equations of motion in terms of relational observables. And then you will again have that the equations of motion relative to different dynamical reference frames, or this is the space of solutions, will look exactly the same relative to the different dynamical frame choices. And that gives you now a way of saying that, in fact, all the laws of physics are the same in every dynamical reference frame. And so in that sense, it's really an update of what we saw before. And not only that, but we're now actually looking at a gauge invariant description that is dependent on the choice of frame. So that's a bit different from before. We had before a description that depends on the choice of fixed coordinate system, but that's not gauge invariant. Here we have a gauge invariant description that, however, depends on the choice of a dynamical reference frame. Okay, so in that sense, it's you can think of this as a relational update of the notion of general covariance to dynamical reference frames. It is, of course, not independent of the usual notion of general covariance. It's really a consequence of that, but it provides you a somewhat more physical way of thinking about these statements, because you can really think of them now in terms of dynamical reference objects. Okay, let me maybe move on. So I don't know how time is going. How much time do I still have left, actually?
Yeah, like a bit more than 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes.
Okay. So maybe, let me talk a little bit about some implications of this framework. So about the CS and gravity, and in particular, let me mention briefly a relational notion of microcausality. And the statement is really what you can show is that when you have two relation observables, let's call them O1 and O2. They may be associated with different frame fields. And these frame fields, they should transform trivially under large diffeomorphisms. So in particular, they should not be geodesics connected to some asymptotic boundary. But then if you have such relation observables, what you'll find is that these relation observables will actually commute at space-like separation in the following sense, that if you look at the support of these relation observables in the orientation space and you map it back to space-time using the frame, and that sits inside space-time, not hitting the boundary, then when these supports or the images of these supports in space-time are space-like separated. Now, in particular, if these frames are actually diffeomorphisms themselves, they're group-valued frames in the sense in which I mentioned before, then note that you know, the local orientation space will, of course, inherit a causal structure from that of space-time just through the dressed metric that I get by basically pushing forward the space-time metric to the local orientation space. So I have a notion of causality also in the orientation space, and it is connected to that of space-time. And okay, under these conditions that I mentioned, so basically the, in some sense, the space-time support or this relational space-time support, if that's space-like separated, then these objects will commute. And I will not have time to discuss that in great detail. Let me just give you a brief idea of how that works. So so we're using in the covariant phase space formulation. So we have some presynthetic form that you get from the variation of the Lagrangian, and we compute the Poisson bracket of these objects by contracting the field space vector fields into it that correspond to this equation here, to variations basically generated by these different relation observables. And when you contract that into the presynthetic form, it takes this form here, where these delta phi one and delta phi two, they're really now components, not field space forms, components, really variations of fields that come by contracting the these field space vector fields associated with the two observables into the field space one form that corresponds to the variation of whatever field we're interested in. And now what one can show is using the Pyle's bracket. So the Pyle's bracket is a covariant form of the Poisson bracket that's equivalent to this construction in terms of the covariant phase space, that at least on the space of solutions, you can always choose a gauge such that these variations, delta phi one and delta phi two, that they vanish outside the domain of influence of the space-time support of these relation observables. So for instance, in the relation observable O2, if I map the support from the orientation space into space-time, and suppose that's maybe this object here, the domain of influence is this yellow region. And it turns out you can always choose a gauge such that that the associated variation delta phi two vanishes outside this yellow region. And similarly, you can do that for the other observable O2. And that means on the space of solutions where omega is preserved, that means you can always choose a hypersurface sigma such that the domains of influence of the two don't overlap on that slice. And so that means you can always choose a Cauchy slice such that these variations are nowhere simultaneously non-vanishing. And when that's true, that means at least on such a slice, at least one of the two will be vanishing everywhere. And so that means this whole thing is going to be zero. And so, yeah.
Leah has a question in the chat. So Lee, you can unmute yourself, yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. I believe it's the case, and I'm interested if this is something that you've thought about. I believe it's the case that a relational diffeomorphism invariant physical observable, which is local, involves not two the way you've mostly indicated here, but three of the naive degrees of freedom. So if you're thinking in terms of Rovelli's non-gauge invariant degrees of freedom that have a relationship that together becomes a local physical degree of freedom, there are actually three different degrees of freedom that have to be named, namely the two that are in relationship and the third which measures the consequence of the relationship.
So I'm not sure I fully understood the question. When you have the first couple of degrees of freedom, when you talk about their relations, you're thinking of those as a relational observable that's already gauge invariant, and then you want to measure those relative to some third object? Is that what you
mean? No, I'm claiming that if you think carefully about what's needed in the general case to take the non-gauge invariant local degrees of freedom and construct from them a gauge invariant physical degree of freedom, that it actually depends on three local fields, not two.
Why is that? So I mean, the thing is here in this case, I mean, maybe let's think about a scalar field that I want to maybe describe relationally relative to some dynamical frame. So the dynamical frame, in many cases, let's think, for instance, in the case of the Brown-Kukac dust, those will be four scalar fields. So I'm actually going to relate some fifth scalar fields that I might be interested in to four other scalar fields. So in that sense, it would actually be a relation of five degrees of freedom. I'm not sure what you exactly meant by three.
I don't mind at all if there are more, but what we believe, this is conversations with Carlo and other people, what we believe is that there's at least three, and that therefore there's a natural algebra of gauge invariant local degrees of freedom that can be take place in an algebra of also, that is the products of the algebras, are also local gauge invariant and physical. You need three of such things. So we should be searching for some three-pocketed extension of what we think of as Perl's brackets or.
Okay. So I'm not, I think that's something I didn't completely understand. So it's, I'd be happy to discuss this more, but I would still stand by my statement here that, you know, the constructions that I'm presenting, that I'm just sketching here, are really giving you something that's gauge invariant. So I'm actually, these relational observables, they're definitely diffeomorphism invariant that I'm constructing here.
I don't disagree with anything you did, if I understood it correctly.
Yeah. Are you referring to the locality arguments here, the microcausality that, you know, O1, O2 might refer to two different kinematical fields that ascribe to a third one, which is the reference frame. And then, okay, in that case, maybe it's something we should discuss later. Otherwise, I will probably not finish. So this argument here is really one that generalizes one by Marov, where you actually also use the Pyle's bracket, but it was really just an argument that was in a paragraph. So this here is a somewhat more sophisticated one. It also generalizes it to frames that are not completely local. They can be they can be non-local. They just shouldn't touch any asymptotic boundary. There's some challenges with boundary conditions that you need to impose when you have asymptotic boundaries. When you compute the Pyle's bracket, you have to solve equations of motion, you look at variations of an action, that will require you to impose certain boundary conditions. And it turns out that when you have reference frames that transform non-trivially under large gauge transformations, then there's issues with finding boundary conditions that are consistent with that, and that. That are consistent with microcausality in the bulk and that lead to consistent solutions everywhere in the bulk. And anyway, this issue is something that in some sense connects a bit to perturbative treatments by Will and Steve Giddings. What I should emphasize here is this argument that we developed is a non-perturbative one. Okay, so I think now I probably really don't have a lot of time at all. I should probably be wrapping up, so that I'm reaching the last topic that I wanted to mention, that's really local subsystems relative to frame, and that connects with the topic of edge modes and finite regions and so on. So do I still have 5 minutes maybe?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, okay, what I have would probably take more, so I have to be really brief here. I mean, the usual, so here, as many of you know, of course, there's issues when you think about subsystems and theories with gauge transformations, because, on the one hand, you have that, gauge invariant information purely associated with a subregion and purely associated with its complement together don't actually determine all the gauge invariant information in the global sphere when you glue these two regions together. This is something you can see, for instance, when you have Wilson lines that cross a certain interface. When you cut this at the interface to split the global system into subregions, for instance, then this Wilson line, this charged, this dressed Wilson line, really, you might split it in this way, into open Wilson lines. Turns out that they're not individually gauge invariant, and so you don't really have a way of reconstructing the global gauge invariant data, the cross-boundary gauge invariant data, just from regional gauge invariant data. So I'm going to rush a bit through it. So another issue is that in gauge theories, when you split off a subregion that's boundary supported gauge transformations turn out to be no longer gauge for the subregion. So it turns out that they're not degenerate directions of the presymplectic structure. And in gravity, you can even have a situation that you don't even get anything integrable at all. That's of course physically makes sense, because if you look at diffeomorphisms that are changing, that are transversal to boundary, then that will correspond to a changing, of course, the system, and it would correspond to some open system dynamics. And now the question is whether one would want to consider these issues that, the regional gauge invariant information and its complements don't determine the full gauge invariant information, plus these issues with what are normally gauge transformations from the point of view of the global theory are not necessarily gauge transformations for the split off regions. So whether that's really an issue or not, that depends a bit on your view. And in fact, in principle, it's not really a problem. You can still do consistent physics in this way. But there's a way in which you can actually remedy this situation. And that's by the introduction of these edge mode fields. So you can, for instance, in the gauge theory case, just assume that maybe if you have some new set of degrees of freedom U that live on the boundary, for instance, here at Z, that are group valued, then I have actually a way. So it's a phase-based extension, really. Then I have a way of turning the whole thing into something gauge invariant, where I can have cross-boundary gauge invariant data that I can actually write in terms of regional gauge invariant data. And for instance, with this this cross-boundary Wilson line here, I could just split it, for instance, into this piece where I address one half of it really with this kind of edge mode field and the other half in this way. And when I take so each of them together, each of these is gauge invariant from the point of view of the subregions. And when I take the product, then I get this global one. And so, and one other thing is that you can show when you do such a phase-based extension, okay, it depends a bit on the choice of symplectic structure, but you can find it in such a way that what would be in the global theory, boundary-supported gauge transformations, they remain gauge also in the subregion. And you can also do something like this for general relativity, vacuum general relativity. If you introduce something like dynamical coordinate systems, that was done also by Will and Laurent many years ago, not so many years ago, actually. And this has actually led to a whole wave of research efforts in recent years of understanding local subsystems and gauge theory and gravity, and also the symmetry properties and so on. One thing we can already take from this here is, of course, that these edge mode fields, this U here, group valued object, it is, of course, a dynamic reference frame field in exactly the same sense in which I've described it before. Likewise, with these dynamical coordinate fields, they're also, at least at an abstract level, dynamical reference frame fields. And what I'm really doing is looking at a gauge invariant dressing of subregion properties, I'm really looking at a relational description of such a subregion. And now, so the very fact that you have something like abstract dynamical reference frames in the sense in which I've spoken about them in this talk already, for these subregions, that's not something new. So that has been there at least since Will's and Laurent's work. But there is a way in which we've extended this picture and made it more explicit as a realization in terms of dynamic reference frame fields in some recent work. And so basically the main aim here is that we want to understand these edge mode reference frames and also all the induced properties such as charges somewhat better from the point of view of the global theory. And in particular, to understand these reference frame fields, not as some kind of postulated degrees of freedom that you add by hand when you look at only the subregion, that are new degrees of freedom from the subregion, but that they're actually degrees of freedom that are already present in the global theory. And that, however, originate in the complement and in some sense are really nothing else than internalized in some sense dynamical external reference frames for a subregion. And one way in which you can realize that is, for instance, if you're interested in some kind of subregion here, is again by some Wilson lines that come from perhaps some asymptotic boundary and that you shoot in. And then in the same sense in which I've explained at the very beginning of the talk, they give rise to a group value reference frame at some bulk points. And they're of course non-local reference frames in this case here, but they give you, it turns out, a realization of this U field that I showed you on the previous slide with all the properties that were needed in the construction by Will and Donnelly, by Will and Laurent to get this gauge invariant subregion description. Now, you can do the same thing in gravity with, for instance, these geodesic frames that I described before. What is important in both cases, in fact, is that these reference frames are non-local and originate in the complement. And why is that? That is because when they originate or have support in the complement, then you have a chance that these objects, these reference frame fields, when you look at them at the level of the subregion, that they really become dynamically independent degrees of freedom there, so that you can vary them independently from the other degrees of freedom in the subregion, and in particular that they don't couple to the bulk action in that subregion. And in particular in general relativity, you can do this. It's important that it's non-local because in the complement, because when the reference frame has support in the causal complement of some subregion physics that you're interested in, then you have a chance that, that gives you enough wiggle room to change the initial data there in such a way that you can change the configuration of that reference frame, projected, of course, through this non-local, let's say through the geodesics, to the subregion without affecting the subregion physics. And so that gives you then a physical way of actually having something like these frame reorientations that only act on the reference frame, but don't act on the other degrees of freedom that I want to describe relative to that reference frame, namely the other degrees of freedom in the bulk of that subregion. And that's something that, of course, you would need to have in order to have that these frame reorientations changing the relation between the frame and the other degrees of freedom, that they're consistent with a space of solutions, that they're tangential to the space of solutions and can give rise to some kind of charges. And so I think I cannot discuss that in any further detail. Let me maybe, I'm already over time. So let me maybe just say that we have shown both for gauge theories and gravity how to implement, how to derive, in fact, an ambiguity-free presymplectic structure that's in fact different from what's on the market in these settings, that's kind of inconsistently implements these things. Basically, and I'm just gonna, okay, somehow it doesn't move. I think if I explained this here, this would take me a little too long, but basically it is a presymplectic structure that's such that gauge transformations from the point of view of the global theory remain gauge transformations at the level of the local subregion description. And in particular, you get a representation of the space-time vector fields on that regional phase space, a consistent constraint algebra. That's really a covariant version of something that Aishan and Kukash did in the 80s in canonical geometry dynamics. And you also get for these frame reorientations, something like a centrally extended corner algebra I probably don't have time to discuss, but that's in fact consistent with some previous work by Chandrasekharan and Anthony Speranza. I should probably stop. Let me maybe, so I'm just gonna jump this here. It's in fact, maybe one of the most important things about these dynamical reference frames, namely what you can show is that the notion of subsystems, such as with these subregions relative to different dynamical reference frames, depends on the choice of reference frame. The observable algebras that you describe in a relational way, the subsystem relative to different frames, they overlap, but they don't coincide. And that at the end of the day actually leads to, that's pretty much at the heart of why many physical properties in a gauge invariant way depend on the choice of dynamical reference frame. And such as, for instance, correlations or even thermal properties, and can even show that things such as whether a subsystem is in equilibrium or not with its complement, that will depend on the choice of dynamical reference frame. But I guess I don't have time to discuss that. I'm already horribly over time. So let me just flash the conclusion slide here at you and just let you read it. And I think I'll just stop here. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you for the very pedagogical talk. First, I would like to ask if students have questions. Hank, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you for the very nice talk. I'm just wondering, is there any need, I guess, or can you justify why we don't want to also dress the dressing, like the dressing for local observables? I don't really understand, I'm not an expert in this field,
Are you asking, so if I have a dressed observable, it's really a relational observable, are you asking why am I not dressing such a dressed observable also maybe relative to another frame? Is that your question?
Because frames, if I just interpret frames as vector fields, right? Or basis in normal frame in tangent space, I can treat the tangent space or the tangent bundle as another space, and then I can dress it again, right?
You can definitely, if you have a dressed or relational observable, you can definitely dress it relative to another frame. It's just that that doesn't give you anything non-trivial. So what you will find is really that as long as these two reference frames are independent or dynamically independent, so what you will get is that the first observable is basically just going to look constant relative to the second reference frame with which
right, but
with
I respect don't to which that, right?
Right. Sorry.
Like for example, you when you dress this A, I'm not sure which slide that was on, but it was one of the beginning okay. slides.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I think it's a slide that was. Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. my pen. It doesn't work very well, so if I go, I don't know. It will probably take me a while to go back to that slide. But the, but basically the thing is something that's already invariant. If I dress it relative to another frame, that thing will really just look constant relative to that
right.
to that other frame.
Right.
So it, and that's in fact really also at the heart of the subsystem relativity that I didn't really discuss here. That has to do with the fact that basically the so if I look at relational observables describing some subsystem here, like the subset of particles relative to one reference frame, these relational observables turn out to be invariant under reorientations of the other frame where I just change the relation between that other frame and the system I'm interested in and vice versa. And so for that reason, I can actually also say that if I want to look at the observables that describe relational observables that describe a system relative to two frames or that are relational observables relative to both frames, those are actually observables that are independent under the reorientations of both frames. And so that are already invariant. So in particular, meaning they're already invariant, that means they just describe internal relations of the system itself. So I could have chosen, for instance, some internal frame within that group of particles in
right.
H theory that would be a subsystem like a subregion. And maybe I choose a dynamical frame that I already have inside that subregion to construct some regional gauge invariant data. And the thing is, yeah, if I just take that regional gauge invariant data and then I want to dress that that gauge invariant data to describe it relative to yet another frame, it kind of gives me a similar trivial
observation. But the thing is, you're assuming that the second dressing is, that the original observable is independent of the second dressing, or the first dressing is independent of the second dressing. So then, but the thing is, if we just, you know, just do it, then you'll be able to dress more stuff. Because like, for example, in the, you assumed that you have to only be able to dress like gauge covariant stuff, like diffeomorphism covariant stuff, which means that you can't dress the Christoffel symbol, for example, right?
You can actually also turn the Christoffel symbol into a gauge invariant object. So I haven't discussed that here, but you can also do that. So it doesn't have to be gauge covariant. It doesn't have to be just a covariant object. So we have it's explained in one of our papers. I think we even have it in an appendix how to do it. So there we give a fairly general description of how you turn even non-covariant objects, so things that aren't tensors, into something gauge invariant.
Okay. I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But yeah, I mean, it's more complicated, and I guess I already went over time, so I couldn't discuss that as well.
Thanks. Bianca, you have a question?
Also as a comment, I think partially it also has been done by Kukoc and some series what Philip mentioned, turning various objects into observables in a given frame. But I had a question about the Brown-Kukoc dust model, where it's with dust, but you mentioned it because, well, it refers to the geodesics of the dust, but on the slide before you didn't have any dust. So I'm wondering whether one can kind of define something very similar to this, just with geodesics. You know, in principle, one should be able to formulate without dust, and then even do.
Okay.
Yeah, and kind of, I wanted to ask if one can define something like the reduced Hamiltonian, and does it look kind of this similar to the Brown-Kukac Hamiltonian?
So that I don't know, but the thing is, yes, so one reason why we found this Duodezek dressing nice is that, yeah, I mean, you can do it even in the absence of any matter reference frame field. So you don't need any dust or any, you don't need any matter at all. You can basically even dress the metric relative to itself. So you describe the metric at some bulk points relative to a Duodezek frame. And so you describe in some sense the metric relative to itself, except that the metric constructed reference frame is one that's non-local through the Duodezek. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of describing some metric degrees of freedom at a bulk point relative to metric degrees of freedom that are supported on some extended object. But the thing is, yes, when you actually work this out, in this Duodezek dressing, you get exactly four scalar fields. It looks exactly the same, pretty much, at least at a formal level, as in the Brown-Kukac model. So effectively that looks the same. Qualitatively, we of course use this asymptotic or this boundary as a reference, and the fact that gauge transformations act trivially there is of course special here, and that's and in the Brown-Kukac model, well, we use the matter field of course to specify perhaps some initial data surface, some Cauchy slice. Then and use that as the anchor point for all these Duodezeks, but other than that, the construction looks qualitatively really the same. But now more specifically to your question about the Hamiltonian, it's true of course that canonically you can deparametrize or you can write down a Hamiltonian relative to Brown-Kukac dust if you can do that relative to a Duodezek frame. That is probably a bit less straightforward. I think what you could probably do is, if you want to look at the Hamiltonian in a subregion, where you what I kind of touched on at the end, where you look at the Duodezek frame as coming from the complement as some additional degrees of freedom that from the point of view of the subregion are sort of new degrees of freedom. They're not new degrees of freedom from the global theory, but in the sense that you're not really, I think, globally deparametrizing it in that relative to that Duodezek frame would be challenging, just because I think it doesn't give you, globally describing the metric relative to itself, there's of course dependence there. So but I think that's
physically, physically there are issues also with focusing of geodesics and so on.
Of course. So I mean, one thing is of course that the Duodezek dressing example that I described, of course, in general, that's even more of a reason why that doesn't work in global, because globally in general, because the you might have as you said, focusing of Duodezek congruences, in which case, in general, the dynamical coordinate system that they set up is also only locally defined in space-time, and whatever that neighborhood is may even depend on the field configuration, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, it's getting late over here, so I'm having some trouble in formulating myself, but that's basically
that. Yeah, so, thank you.
Florian, go ahead.
Hi, Philippe. Nice to see you. I had a quick question. So, when people look at symmetries with the boundaries and stuff like that, they look at the generators. They're very careful at checking out if the generators are field dependent or not, and that this has consequences. And so, for me, I really never understood the physical meaning of that. And I thought it was pretty, in a way, irrelevant. I mean, mathematically important, but maybe irrelevant. But now I seem to understand that, in fact, if you want to look at the relational picture, the field-dependent transformations are kind of the physical relevant one, right? Because if you have a frame, if you look at symmetries relating frames, this symmetry transformation should depend on the frame, but the frame is a field. So in fact, in your perspective, that would be the kind of the physical structure, not the symmetry transformation, which are not depending on fields, are kind of irrelevant in a way. Is this understanding correct?
Yeah, more or less. So the thing is, okay, I think when it comes to, what is true is that the reference frame changes. These are, well, dynamic, so field-dependent coordinates transformations, and they are relational observables. And so they can be something like field-dependent diffeomorphisms. However, they're not really what are usually considered as the symmetries in these constructions with these boundaries here, kind of what I'm flashing here on the slides. Maybe I didn't describe that very well, but these symmetries, they actually correspond more to what I called frame reorientations. So these are things where you change the relation between the reference frame and the degrees of freedom you want to change, describe relative to that frame. So, and the question is whether these transformations that you use to change the reference frame orientation, really, or the configuration, whether those are field dependent or not. And in general, yeah, you can consider those to be field dependent. And I think one of the reasons why people often look at it is that if you want to preserve certain boundary conditions, then it often turns out to be necessary to have these transformations field dependent. So here in this construction that we did, constructing these charges or these symmetry algebras, we actually look only at field independent ones. And I think in most of these local subregion symmetry algebras, these corner algebra constructions, I think in most cases, people look also really only at field independent such transformations. I think field dependent ones are more considered when you look at like asymptotic structures or so, but I'm not 100% sure about this.
I was wondering like here you have a subregion. What happened in the limit when the subregion is taking all the space time and you want to put some boundary condition there?
So that's a very good question. So I don't have a very good answer to that. So we haven't really looked at this. That's something we would like to study actually, because indeed, that's of course the obvious thing to ask when you think of these corner or these symmetry charges on the boundary of some finite subregion, and how are they related to soft modes or something like this at the asymptotics. And somehow you would think that with this picture that we're providing here, where we're giving a realization of these edge modes that are otherwise sort of postulated in terms of these non-local reference frames that come from the complement, that this provides you mapping between soft modes and these soft charges really and these finite region charges. But I'm not entirely sure that this is a completely trivial question to answer. And I think, taking these asymptotic limits often leads to some non-trivialities, I guess. Even when BMS looked at these asymptotic symmetries, I guess initially they were expecting that asymptotically I would just get something like Poincaré transformations, and I realized that's actually not so trivial, and you get something much larger that one might not have naively expected. And so I think something similar might happen here, that maybe the relation isn't quite that simple. But and I think also the algebras the symmetry algebras are not, typically not even isomorphic. So I think that's probably something, so the asymptotic ones and the finite ones. So I guess there's really some non-trivial stuff happening there. And another thing is that, when you think about it, asymptotically gauge transformations acting trivially, then asymptotically, you don't really need these dynamic reference frames. And so that you do need for these constructions here at finite distance. So there's also with the dynamic reference frame some non-trivialities that probably are going to happen. I don't have a very good answer to that question. But I think it's a very good one, yes.
Yeah, good. Thank you very much. And I think Lee and Bianca are thanking you for your talks, and I had to go because I had a meeting. So let's thanks again, Philip, for his talk. And and I guess it's later. Thank you very much. And and I don't know if someone wants to stay longer, but I will have to go too. So thanks for the talk. And
bye, Philip.
Thanks very much. Cheers. Thanks. Bye-bye for you.